This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
BBC Sounds. Hello, Lucy White here from BBC Scotland's Podlitical. We'll let you get back to Scotland Outdoors in just a moment, but first I want to tell you about our podcast. We're a team of political journalists who like to unpick what's actually happening at the Scottish Parliament and Westminster. We look at all these political decisions and what they mean for you and me, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. We have a new episode every Thursday at 6pm. Subscribe to Podlitical on BBC Sounds. Now back to Scotland Outdoors.
The Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. Today we're wandering a wee bit outside our usual subject matter because we've come across something that we think is not just very interesting but also highly relevant to the Scottish countryside, and arguably how it looks today.
Yeah, when people around the world think of Scotland, they tend to think of heather-clad moors, lochs and glens, deer in the glens, grouse in the high tops, all that kind of thing. And a lot of Scotland does look like that because a big percentage of our land is still made up of big estates, many of which are run for sporting purposes. But the interesting question is, how did these estates come into being?
Recent research came up with a rather startling fact that many of these estates in the North and West Highlands were bought by the beneficiaries of what's called slavery-derived wealth.
The majority changed hands between 1790 and 1855, which coincidentally were the main years of the Highland clearances, when tens of thousands of folk were forcibly evicted from their ancestral homes and either sent to other areas, usually on the coast, to work for landlords, or shipped off overseas to try and make new lives for themselves.
Now, this new research was carried out by Dr. Ian McKinnon from Skye, and now based at Coventry University, and Dr. Andrew McKillop, a senior lecturer in Scottish history at Glasgow University, who's originally from Harris. I'm going to start with you, Ian. Just define for me, what do you mean by slavery-derived wealth?
It comprises two categories: direct beneficiaries of slavery and indirect beneficiaries of slavery. So we consider direct beneficiaries of slavery to be slave owners and slave traders, and indirect beneficiaries of slavery are their descendants, but also people who are involved in commercial enterprises that relied on plantation labour, so tobacco, cotton, sugar, and also the descendants of people who are involved in that, and also people who married into slavery families with a substantial slavery-derived wealth.
Andrew, how did you go about doing this research?
It's worth pointing out that there's in a sense, a confluence of two types of researches here, Ewan. There's my own research, which looks at empire wealth more generally, which, in a sense, looks at the global capital flows coming off empire, and Ian's more specific research specialisms on land and clearance in the West Highlands and Islands. So it was, if you like, a genuine cooperation between someone looking at the British Empire in general and someone who was looking at the more specific issues of land in the West Highlands and Islands.
So the stuff that you were doing, Ian, how did you come up with the information that you did?
I began with two data sets or databases. The first is a fully searchable online database of people who received compensation for slaves as property, the loss of their property when slavery was abolished in 1833. There's a project at University College London called Legacies of British Slavery that has a list of these people and also is fleshing out biographies of who they were, and is also introducing other people connected with slavery prior to the compensation payout. And I married the entries in that database with, at the start, a list of estate purchasers that Tom Devine had compiled for one of his book chapters maybe 20 years ago, and looked to see the connections between them. And then once I'd done that, I began then to look at things like the Register of Say Signs, newspaper articles from the 19th century, and other sources, just to see where further connections might exist.
Just clarify this for me. When you talk about a compensation scheme, we're not talking about compensating the slaves. We're talking about compensating the owners of slaves, the people who are basically benefiting from this trade. How much money were we talking about? How big was the compensation?
The compensation in 1834 terms was £20 million, and it's been estimated by the Legacies of British Slavery team that amounts to £16 billion in today's terms.
Why did they buy estates in Scotland? Were they just awash with cash and almost money laundering springs to mind, for a better expression? What was going on here?
That's a great question, Ewan, and I think there's a couple of things that need to be borne in mind here. The scale of the compensation package which the owners of enslaved people are in receipt of from the British government was completely unprecedented. I think perhaps the best way to think of that compensation package is to think that it really isn't matched in scale until we get the bailout of the banks after 2008. We're talking that level of public subsidy of this type of group of people. And as you see, they end up with a huge amount of surplus capital. And the question is, what is this new elite going to do with their wealth? Now, they do a lot of things with it. They invested into railways, they invested in much of the modern economy. But there are particular reasons why land in the West Highlands and Islands is attractive for those type of individuals. If we think about it, you know, we put ourselves into the shoes of those families and think about the nature of their wealth, not just the volume of wealth, but the nature of it. These are families, often from relatively new, if you like, socially aspiring backgrounds, whose wealth comes from some of the most, we would say, modern, but you could equally say brutally exploitative parts of the world economy. They're conscious of the fact that in a British society which is increasingly abolitionist and repelled by the former slavery economies, that their wealth is held in extremely low esteem. So they want to, in a sense, change their wealth, change the nature of their capital from one form into another. Now, getting compensated by the government starts that process, but land has particularly useful cultural connotations. Land is stable, it's constant, it's natural, it's, if you like, made by God. Slavery wealth is man-made, it's unstable, it's transient, and it's increasingly seen by very many people rightly as deeply immoral. If you like, land acts as the perfect cultural antidote to the problematic nature of this wealth. And where better in 19th century Britain than, in a sense, to go to where land has those particularly virtuous connotations? The Highlands is deemed to be natural, it's deemed to be in a state of nature, it's deemed to be wild and authentic. It provides the ideal setting, if you like, for which you can launder your wealth from this modern, unstable, immoral set of formats into a much more natural and ultimately respectable form of wealth. And that is probably one of the key cultural dynamics which explains why these elites are buying up so much land in the West Highlands.
What kind of percentage are you looking at in the Highlands and the Western Isles that were bought off the back of the slave trade?
It's in the Outer Hebrides. All the land between the Butt of Lewis and Barra Head was in the hands of slavery beneficiaries in the 19th century. John Gordon of Cluny bought Barra and South Uist and Bimbecula. He received compensation money along with his brother for slaves in the Caribbean. Lord Dunmore bought Harris, and his father or grandfather was a governor of Virginia and of the Bahamas, I think, and owned slaves in both areas. You had the Mackenzie Seaforth on Lewis. He was also the governor of a slave colony and owned slaves in Berbice. And a North Uist was bought in the 1850s by John Powlett Ord, who had married into a Campbell family with substantial slavery connections. Overall, for the West Highlands and Islands as we defined it, it's 1.1 4 million acres that were bought by beneficiaries of slavery, either direct or indirect beneficiaries of slavery, and that comes in at 1 in 3 acres of the entire landmass of the West Highlands and Islands.
See, this is extraordinary, Andrew. I mean, we've got a situation here where people are being compensated for what's, you know, a sort of morally repugnant trade. They're not just laundering the money, they're laundering their reputations by buying this land. But we said right at the beginning, this is coincident with the Highland clearances at the same time. So when they turned up in the Highlands and the Western Isles, is it your impression that they took the mindset with them that, you know, humans were just commodities?
This new elite tend to be getting interested in the Highland land market at precisely a point when the Highland economy is beginning to struggle. Older forms of activity, the cattle markets, particularly for the West Highlands, the kelping markets, are struggling. And through the 1810s, 20s, 30s and 40s, these older West Highland estate economies are really beginning to falter and in some case fail. That's leaving a lot of established families with really very large amounts of acres and large amounts of population living on those acres, in a sense, increasingly economically vulnerable. And as indebtedness takes hold, in effect, these older families are forced to put their estates onto the market at what, for this new elite, are extremely attractive rates. So what we're seeing is the passing of many of the older families, in a sense, losing their landed status, and the new elite arriving in, not just with new wealth, but with very new ideas about how they want to both reshape these estates and, in a sense, reshape themselves at the same time. They have, as we've already discussed, what by contemporary standards are vast reserves of capital. And they can do what those older families struggle to do. If you're a landed family and you're in debt, it's actually quite difficult to change an estate economy. You're required, in a sense, to almost keep the old order on a care and maintenance basis, simply in order to service your debts, if you like, to keep the repayments up. These new elites don't have that problem. They've got the estate, and essentially it's now a blank slate upon which they can begin to deploy their surplus capital. And you're absolutely right, Mark, to point out that they're not just coming with new money, they're coming with attitudes which reflect the backgrounds they're used to. They see everything in high productivity terms. They are used to wealth which entails treating human beings in the most exploitative and brutal fashion. Productivity is everything. In a sense, social resilience and community come a very, very, very distant second, if even that. Now, that is not to say, of course, that they treat populations and Highland estates in the same way that they treated the populations in the plantations. That's not what we're seeing. But they are taking a similarly extractive attitude to their land. It means that they can move entire populations. There is, if you like, an overlap between the arrival of the new elite and an intense phase of clearance, which occurs essentially from the 1790s and is particularly at its height from the 1830s to 1860s, precisely the period when Ian noted that there was a big overlap between slave compensation beneficiaries and attitudes in the land and attitudes to purchasing the land. That means, in effect, you can correlate slave compensation and at least some instance of Highland clearance.
One of the things that fascinates me about this, Ian, is it to a certain extent, it's established a pattern. You know, because I've spoken to landowners today. There is, I think, a quite clear perception that, you know, if you buy a big estate nowadays, yes, it's indicating you have the money to do it, but it's also indicating that you can afford to lose the money that's usually entailed with running an estate. It's established a pattern, however many years ago, that there are still very strong echoes of it today.
Yes, I think the expenditure that some of this new elite were putting out on aggrandizing themselves in their new surroundings is remarkable, both in terms of the built architecture. One of the cases that really struck me was the development of a railway through Invergarry from Spion Bridge up to Fort Augustus, which was being led by speculative capitalists and the local landed elite, several of whom were slavery beneficiaries. And effectively, they got this thing up and running, despite the fact that it was financially a basket case. And it was really led by the Ellis family, who had bought Glengarry, and their sporting tenant on Glencoich, Lord Burton, the brewing magnate. And it ran for a few years, and then Lord Burton gave up his sporting lease of Glencoich, and a few years following that, it ceased to operate. So there was tremendous kind of conspicuous consumption and expenditure going on relating to some of these beneficiaries.
There's an interesting confluence between changing attitudes to the way in which societies are organised all over Britain, Ireland, and indeed across the empire. You have new Whig or Liberal governments that have come into power really since the early 1830s. And it's very interesting that almost the holy grail in policy terms, interestingly, is a concept of property. And if you're going to in any way interfere with the private rights of property, then you have to compensate the person for it. Now, that explains why it's something which we find so difficult to understand and find morally repugnant now, namely that you would compensate the slave owner, not the poor enslaved person, conforms exactly to that Whig and Liberal logic. The result, however, is also that they apply it upon Highland estates and, for that matter, large parts of Ireland. If people are no longer, in effect, producing a productive impact on property, then it's the people you move, it's not the property. There's a prioritising of property in this age that's cold economic calculus. It also, in a sense, helps these new Scottish and British elites. It conforms to the romantic ideas of the Highlands, the beautiful mountains, the great glens. In that imagined landscape, small local communities working in local economic ways just doesn't fit your perception. The result is, in effect, they're surplus to requirements. So there is both a sort of economic and a cultural set of reasons aligning, which basically mean you want rid of these people. And that's why we have this intense phase from the 1830s to 1860s, where the populations of the Highlands, once really quite vibrant communities, are moved really quite systematically on a large scale out to, of course, frontier parts of the empire. So they're more relocated within a wider British global system as opposed to got rid of completely.
Was there an element of the Jacobite rising hangover here that they were saying, actually, let's get these people off the land? What was the driving force? Is this just this romantic thing of the empty Highland Glen? What was the motivation?
I think that is a very powerful motivation at the time. I mean, there are two kind of different images of the Highlands in the 18th century, one of them coming out of the post-Jacobite uprising and the government reprisals, and there was a view that the area was needed to be pacified, needed to be civilised, it was savage, fearful. And so there was this real drive for development, first of all by the Board of the Annexed Estates, so it's a state-led intervention, and then through private enterprise, through the large lairds in the period of the kelping, for instance, but also the reformation of estates. And it was driven by these Enlightenment ideas, and it was also a badge of your success that you could do this. And there were agricultural societies set up to extol these experiments and progress. And on the other hand, you have later part of the 18th century, James Macpherson's Ossian poems that perfectly sort of encapsulate this romanticisation. They're based on a genuine tradition. They're based on the stories and the poem songs of the Fianna tradition, the Finn McCool legends. But the way that he changes them makes them almost unrecognisable to the source material. But they have this huge impact, both in terms of, you know, are they genuine or not? Scholars are still fighting over that today. But also it has ramifications even beyond Britain. It goes out into Europe. It's inspiring political change, scholarship. It's the image of the Highlands at the heart of it. Then you have Sir Walter Scott on top of that. The people coming in, inspired by that, to buy the land, are then accentuating that and taking it further. So, for instance, again, the Ellis family at Glengarry were patrons of Sir Edwin Landseer, who painted The Monarch of the Glen, which is still today seen as being the kind of the iconic image of what the Highlands should be, as you referred to earlier.
It's noticeable that the estate management economies that develop in this period are frankly much more one-dimensional. If you went to an older Highland estate, there was in a sense a lot of macroeconomies. The local Balchin or townships sort of had a lot of incredibly microeconomies based around part farming, part woolen production, textile, part cattle. There was in a sense almost a mixed economy that reflected a set of social needs. If you have that amount of capital as a new landlord, you can in effect make the whole estate reflect what you want it to be. So that's why we talk about these estates as sort of monopoly land use. They shift everything over to hunting. They shift everything over to deer or everything over to fishing or to sheep. In other words, notice there's in a sense a loss of diversity, and you get the sort of, in a way, ecologically barren landscapes we see today. And that's one of the legacies of not just this new capital, but the attitudes that that capital brings with it.
Your research period goes back to 1790, Ian. Now, if you look at someone like Tom Johnson's Scotland's Noble Families or Andy Whiteman's Who Owns Scotland, it's apparent that, you know, there are estates who have been in certain families' hands for a long, long time. Now, are there still people owning estates in the area that you were looking at that date back to 1790? And if so, did they know about this history? Did you talk to them about it?
The period goes back to 1726. The first purchase related to slavery that we've found was Daniel Campbell of Shawfield, who bought the whole of Islay and a big part of Judah back then. And there are several throughout the 18th century, but it really takes off from 1790 up through to the 1850s with this peak period in the middle of the 1830s, immediately after the compensation payout. Not only that, but there are, as well as the purchases, there are also existing families, so traditional families who are either involved in the plantation economy or marry into families that have been involved in the plantation economy. It turns out, really, that most of the new elite haven't really stayed. I can think of maybe three or four families that bought in the 19th century that are still there of the new elite. However, of the traditional families, I calculated that at the end of the 19th century, those families owned about 700,000 acres in the Highlands, and almost all of them are still major landowners today. I mean, the figure of 1 in 3, it's actually 1 in 2 acres that were linked to slavery-derived wealth, because in addition to the people who were buying land, you had these families that already had land. And the question is, to what degree did the wealth that came into their families through their connections with slavery help them to ride out this revolution in land ownership that was going on in the first half of the 19th century?
Coming back to my original question, did you take this research and take it back to any of the existing landowners who can trace the family history back to that period and say, look, did you know about this?
No, I've not done that. I mean, I think that may come out as the research findings are disseminated, but they're still important families in their localities today, and it may provoke discussions in those areas as to the nature of landed power in those communities.
Do you think people are aware this is not a proud heritage we have?
Well, I can say, growing up on Skye in the 1980s, 1990s, there was certainly a residual memory of clearance. That clearance is a word used to really describe a much wider sense of bitterness that also includes, you know, language, culture, the destruction of a way of life. Clearance kind of sums up that. But there was no real understanding, at least in my recollection of it, of where those people had made their money, had acquired their wealth and their lands.
Andrew, the compensation scheme came in 1834, and it was to compensate the owners, not the slaves, as we've said before. The government just can't suddenly find that kind of money down the back of the sofa. They must have borrowed it. When did we finish paying that off? Because £20 million back then was a huge sum of money.
The sum of £20 million for the compensation scheme, and I suppose, is an eloquent statement of just how central to Britain's commercial and financial power, and indeed its imperial status, the enslavement of human beings was. It's such a vast sum that it speaks to how central slavery was. to almost any facet of British society you wish to put your eye to. And certainly the government recognised that, that here were a group, as they saw it, of privileged property owners that they needed to compensate and keep on board. We actually, as British taxpayers, finished paying off that at the time unprecedented public loan in 2015. So that means if you were in any way a British taxpayer, regardless of your social or political views, or in probably more importantly, of your ethnic background, you were, in a sense, part of the legacy by which a British government decided that it would pay off the slave owners, not the enslaved.
You could be a British taxpayer of colour in 2015 and you were paying off compensation to slave owners from 1834.
You were, as a British taxpayer, contributing to a national government effort to pay off that compensation process. And if you paid tax before 2015, that tax money went into the general governmental effort to liquidise that compensation package. So yes, you were, in a sense, contributing to paying off compensation. Absolutely.
And what about reparation for all of this in Scotland? Is that something you've looked at?
In terms of reparation, I think it is a huge and complex question, and it's certainly one that's too big for me to say anything authoritative on. I do feel, as someone who has grown up in the Northwest, you could argue that there is a form of reparation going on there today, in the sense that more and more communities are taking the step, the responsibility of buying their own land. I remember on one of your programmes, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you were speaking with David Cameron, who at that point was the head of Community Land Scotland, and he was very important to the North Harris estate buyout. And he told you, and the words have stayed with me, that he said, when you buy the land, something magical happens. He said, I can't put it any more firmly than that, but something magical happens. And you can see the kinds of developments that are going on there now. There is a repair process, a recovery process going on. And you can call it reparative in the sense that there is government support for that. You know, there is a Scottish land fund that provides support for financial support for communities wishing to buy land. Okay, it appeared and then it disappeared and it's now back again for the moment. Equally, you have the what used to be called the Community Land Unit providing advice and guidance for communities who are thinking of doing that, and presumably after they've done the buyout as well, there's support there. In terms of the bigger picture of what's descendants of those people who were enslaved, I can't speak for them other than to say that when I hear them advocate their arguments, I find them compelling. I think they have a strong case, and I think it's very telling that the institution that Andrew works at, Glasgow University, has accepted that argument and is engaged in a form of reparative relationship with an institution in the Caribbean. And I suspect more institutions in Scotland may be taking similar steps in the future. I certainly hope so.
In our conclusions, I think both Ian and I made it clear that this is an historical report about the way history has panned out in relationship to land and people in the Highlands and an important, very important intersection with Britain's history of slavery. I think what we tried to suggest in our conclusions was that there really ought to be, not just, I think, from families that continue to hold acreage in the Highlands and the communities on those estates, that those communities and landowning families start to think humbly and seriously about what these connections mean, and that there start to be acknowledgements that the scale of what Ian uncovered, I think, should be acknowledged by communities, and particularly by proprietors in the Highlands, and that should be the start of a set of probably at times uncomfortable conversations and acknowledgements. But I think our job was probably to uncover the evidence, and it's for others, in a sense, to start carrying those sort of conversations forward, we would hope.
Thank you very much to Drs. Andrew MacKillop and Ian MacKinnon there for sharing their findings with us. Now, we've been in touch with Scottish Land and Estates, who are effectively the Landowning Federation in Scotland, because we felt it was important to get their response to this report. And here's what they said.
This is from Sarah Jane Lang, who is Chief Executive of Scottish Land and Estates, representing land-based businesses across Scotland, including community members. She says, understanding Scotland's history and any connections to the slave trade is important. However, it is a bit of a stretch to leap from a review of social history and ancient connections to slavery as being a reason why communities should own land today. Indeed, the authors of this paper admit themselves there are few, if any, families in the area who are major landowners today and who have any past connection to slavery. A multiplicity of land ownership types exists in modern-day Scotland, including public, private and community-owned land. Community groups across Scotland do own land and buildings, are encouraged to do so, and are supported in their efforts by legislation and through willing collaboration. Rather than producing reports that look backwards and seek to create negative public perceptions of private landowners, we urge Community Land Scotland and others to look forward and work collaboratively to ensure that owners of all types deliver economic, environmental and societal benefits from the best use of land.
A statement there from Scottish Land and Estates. We'd very much welcome your thoughts on what you've heard on this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From all of us in BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.